Hello everyone, this is Martin Willis, and I've decided that I'm going to be offering the full show for free from now on. I really appreciate your support. Anyone can do that. All you have to do is go over to podcastufo.com. You can also support us on Patreon. And it wouldn't hurt if you left a review over at iTunes. I would appreciate that as well. As always, thank you for listening and enjoy today's show. Hello, and good tidings to all. Happy New Year, everyone. And, you know, we're running the show on Sunday instead of Tuesday. We're going to be back to our regular time next week. Next week, we actually have a couple of executive producers from Project Blue Book, the History Channel series. That's going to wrapped up in the first hour and the second hour. We're going to have Ted Rowe from Hawaii. He's going to be on. Should be a great show next week. Tonight, I'm pretty excited about it. It's a different kind of show than we normally do. We may touch, I hope we do touch on the UFO topic, but mostly we're going to be focusing on Star Trek. Now, Star Trek had a huge impact on myself and my friends when I was growing up. I don't recall the original series but I did catch, I think every day after school, I caught the reruns, maybe a few years after. I'm not sure exactly what years, but I also had friends that were into it, so we talked a lot about it. And I just loved I loved the original series. And I'm going to be honest with you, I've loved the original series, and I've loved the Star Trek movies that have come out, but I've never got into the other generations of Star Trek. But that's just my own preferences. But anyway, I'm excited about the show. Our guests, we have Mark Cushman and Vic Mignogna, and I hope I pronounced that right. And Mark is an author and Los Angeles-based screenwriter and director. And his television assignments include scripts for Star Trek, The Next Generation. Oh, sorry about that, what I just said a few minutes ago. Beyond Belief, Fact or Fiction.
That's okay.
And The Diagnosis Murder. We're going to be talking about this, I Spy, a history of the groundbreaking television series and the definitive examinations of making of the original Star Trek series. With his 2,100-page, three-volume set, These Are the Voyages. And Vic is also joining us. He plays Captain Kirk, does a great job with the series. We're going to be talking about that. And he's been a voice actor for more than 300 animated series and video games. He's also a longtime music composer, producer, and performer, and executive producer of what we'll be talking about tonight, a highly popular, I can't believe how many people are watching this, Star Trek Continues. And I started watching myself, and I'm really loving it so far. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I don't even know where to begin. I mean, I'm just really excited that you could both join us. But let's talk about, I don't know who wants to start it, but let's talk about what got you interested in the series Star Trek to begin with. I mean, you're obviously huge fans, both of you. I don't know who wants to start.
Well, I'm older, so I'll go first because I did catch it on NBC, and Vic was still in the cradle. I was about 10 years old and started watching it during the reruns of the first season on NBC and continued through the rest of the series and then caught up on the ones I had missed on syndication. And it hooked me right away. I was the last kid in school to see it because I lived on a dairy farm in Oregon, and we were surrounded by mountains. And the NBC affiliate from Portland, Channel 8, only came in during the summer months. It would fizzle in, and it'd be a little bit of a snowy picture, but you could see it. And so all the kids were raving about this show called Star Trek. And I'll tell you, something that really got me is one day I was in there, and the teacher, Mrs. Ruff, but she was actually very nice. It was a Thursday night, and she started to tell us what the homework assignment was going to be, and there was this collective moan across the room. And she said, I know, it's Star Trek night. Okay, no homework. And I thought, I don't know what this Star Trek is, but I like it. And everyone was telling me about it, and it sounded great. I was still watching Lost in Space and Voyage Beyond the Sea because those are the channels we could get. And the first one I caught was Devil in the Dark, the one about the Horta. I caught about half of it before the channel fizzled out. So I was kind of just straining to see this show over those summer months, and then finally got to see it starting in the second season. And it hooked me right away because I noticed something about it. Even at that young age, I knew I wanted to be a writer, and writer for TV. And it was better written than any of the other shows. And I thought, this is amazing. The dialogue was crisper. The themes were stronger. It was just had such more impact on me than the other shows I was watching, especially the Irwin Allen shows. And I found out later why, after I met Gene Roddenberry and interviewed him for a local LA TV station program, and then came back and pitched to him for Next Generation with the episode Sarek, which he bought. And I asked him, I said, you know, I love that book, The Making of Star Trek, which you guys wrote while the show was in production, and it mostly focuses on the pilots and trying to get the show up and running. I said, and it's filled with memos. Did you keep all those memos from all the other episodes? And he said, yeah, we got about 45 boxes, which is thousands, tens of thousands of memos and production reports and budgets and everything else. Didn't have the Nielsen ratings, so we had to license those from AC Nielsen for every single episode. But anyway, he invited me to go ahead and do these books, and he was my first interview, and then he plugged me into Dorothy Fontana and John D.F. Black and Bob Justman and on, and then the cast members and guest stars and crew members, and I just interviewed them for years, knowing one day I would get around to this, but I was so busy doing screenwriting that I didn't have time to do this giant project. It was supposed to be one book. But when with all these memos, and then when my publisher licensed all the Nielsen ratings, and we found out that there was so much folklore out there about Star Trek. And with the ratings, the show did much better than we'd ever been told. Everybody, even today, you'll say Star Trek was a failure on NBC. No, it was not. It quite often won its time slot, especially during the first season on Thursday night. It was NBC's top-rated Thursday night show. They moved it to Fridays. It was their top-rated Friday night show, and they tried to cancel it. And they got a million people who wrote in, either by letters or petitions, so they renewed it and put it in the death slot, Fridays from 10 to 11. And the first episode, right out of the gate for the third season, Spock's Brain, not a good one, but it's the one NBC wanted to lead off with, won its time slot against Judd for the Defense, which had won an Emmy the previous year for Best Dramatic Series, and the two-hour premiere episode of Hawaii Five-0, which ran for 12 years. Now, the ratings did come down during that third year in that terrible, terrible time slot, but it was still the network's strongest-rated show on that night for quite a ways. So it's not true about the ratings. So why did they cancel it? It's all in the memos. Every episode was a fight with the network. Gene Roddenberry wanted to tell stories that had never been told on TV before. He wanted to talk about Vietnam, sexism, racism, religion, and these memos that are in the books that anybody can read show the battles over every single episode, and you've also got the ratings reports and a lot of other stuff right from the files that disprove so much of the folklore about the original series.
Wow, that is so amazing. I had no idea. I actually have seen what you're talking about, the memos and things like that, because my real life, I'm a fine arts and estate appraiser, and I did the appraisal for the estate of Merv Griffin, and I saw his notes all over a Sonny and Cher show and things like that, and it was more fascinating than anything else is to just to see what they were thinking as they were doing, you know, going along.
And the battles they had to fight. You know, the networks were so restrictive about what an entertainment show could do in prime time and the subjects that were taboo.
Oh,
and Star
yeah.
Trek was crossing the barrier with everything, the first interracial kiss.
That's right.
The miniskirt. It was the first time America saw a miniskirt, and so many other things. And so it was just too hot for the network. It was too sexy. It was too hot. It was too controversial. They were trying to talk Irwin Allen into doing a show for NBC because he had lost his space on CBS and Voyage to Bombay and Time Tunnel and Land of the Giants on NBC. And I'm sorry, on ABC. And so when they tried to cancel Star Trek after the second year, they contacted Irwin and said, come in and do a sci-fi show for us, and we'll give you Star Trek's time slot. But then they got all those protest letters. And I can guarantee you, Vic did not write one of them. He was still too young. So I'll kick it over to Vic,
yeah,
because he discovered the show when you did, Martin, in the 1970s in reruns.
I think that's when it was, in the 1970s, because I'd come home from school, and they would be, you know, in sometime in the afternoon, and... You know, but we were all talking about it at school. I don't remember talking about it when it was out, but anything's possible because I'm probably about the same age as you. All right, Vic, let's hear it.
Okay, well, first of all, first things first.
Okay.
My last name is pronounced Mañana.
Mañana.
Almost like Mignana, the morning, like see you tomorrow. Tomorrow.
And it's like, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. It's Italian, but it's pronounced like Mañana.
Okay.
All right. And I wasn't in
sorry
the crate.
About that.
No worries. I wasn't in the cradle, Mark, but I was probably close to it. I was about 7 years old when the show was canceled in 69. And it was early 70s, like 71 maybe, 72, when I discovered the show. I was about 9 or 10. My mom and I had just moved into an apartment by ourselves, and we had very little furniture. But I do remember that we had a 19-inch black and white television that sat on the floor because we had no table for it. And I would come home every day after school and lay on the floor and watch this show. I stumbled across it, and I loved it. The first episode I ever saw was The Tholian Web, which was a third-season episode. And then I went to school, and I would tell my friends about it. And much to my surprise, a lot of them knew about it. And I started, you know, Martin, I started doing things because of my love for Star Trek, creative things that I had never tried before. I wanted suddenly at 10 or 11 years old, 12 years old, I wanted to try to build props like they had on the show. And then I wanted to make costumes like they wore on the show. And then I wanted to build models. And then I got my parents to let me use their 8mm movie camera so that I could make little episodes and rounded the kids in the neighborhood up and made them wear the costumes that I had made. And Star Trek inspired me.
Wow.
You know, when you're a little kid, you kind of stumble across the things that you're good at. You know, as you grow older, you come across things and you try something for the first time and you're like, wow, I'm actually pretty good at this. You didn't know until that moment when something in your life inspired you. And for that, for me, Star Trek was that thing. So now fast forward several decades, and I'd been a lifelong fan. And then about 6 years ago, maybe seven now, I decided, even though there were a lot of fan productions out there, they all missed on different levels, whether it was the storytelling or the writing or the acting or the lighting or the sets, or the edit, or the music, or anything. So many different areas of production. And I thought to myself, you know, I majored in film in college, and I've studied a lot about production. I've been acting since I was 10 years old, incidentally, because of Star Trek. I started auditioning for school plays because I loved Star Trek, and I wanted to do what Bill Shatner and Leonard Nimoy were doing. And so I decided to take all of those skills that I'd been working on and developing over the decades and maybe make an episode of Star Trek the way I remember it and do it as good as I could to pay tribute, just to honor that show. So I made the first episode. I rounded a bunch of friends up who also happened to be very gifted artists in their different fields of production, whether it be makeup or sound or lighting or camera. And we made an episode. I self-funded it. We built the studio and recreated all the sets And we made an episode called Pilgrim of Eternity, which was a sequel to an original series episode called Who Your listeners remember that episode. And we actually got Mike Forrest, who played Apollo 40 years previously, to reprise his role as Apollo. We made this one episode not knowing how anyone would respond, whether they would like it or not. Star Trek fans are a pretty particular bunch, as I'm sure you probably know. But lo and behold, people really enjoyed it. So we launched some crowdfunding campaigns, and we ended up making 11 full-length episodes. As I told you before we came on the air, everyone is better than the last. Our own dear Mark Cushman here wrote the script for episode 5 based on a story of mine. Judy Burns, who wrote The Tholian Web, wrote our 8th episode. And our series, now with over 10 million viewers, picks up right where the original series was canceled and finishes the 5-year mission. And we tell stories that explain how the Enterprise ends up in dry dock, how it finishes the 5-year mission, why Captain Kirk is an admiral and accepts promotion, why is Spock back on Vulcan. We leave everybody right where they were when the motion picture begins. It is a perfect filler between the original series and the motion picture.
Wow.
And we've been humbled and gratified by so many people that have loved it. Rod Roddenberry, Gene's son. Not only did he do a cameo on one of our episodes, but he publicly has stated many, many times that if his dad were alive today, he would consider Star Trek Continues canon. And Rod himself does consider it canon. So we've been very fortunate to have a great deal of enthusiasm around our series.
Wow.
Well, and not only that I introduced Vic to John D.F. Black, who was the associate producer on the original first season of the original show. And he's the one who wrote the line, Space, the Final Frontier, and he wrote the classic episode, The Naked Time, which won a Hugo Award. And John sat in as a story editor on Star Trek Continues as well, and I did too, to give Vic notes on the scripts and make sure that this thing was what would be, which Vic would have done anyway, but we pitched in and helped as the best we could, and to make it be like the 4th, 5th season of the original Star Trek. And I think he's done an astonishing job. It's anybody out there who hasn't seen it, go to StarTrekContinues.com and watch a couple episodes, and you'll feel like you're getting those shows that we weren't given after NBC canceled the series.
Yeah, I agree. I'm in the 3rd episode now, and I wondered when I saw Apollo if that was the original actor.
He's
you know, quite an iconic. I mean, he's a great actor. Really takes the scenes. You know, kind of dominates the scenes because he's that good.
But yeah, and you know what, Martin? We've had many, many guest stars from many, many different iconic TV series. We've had people from Doctor Who. We've had actors from Buck Rogers, The Incredible Hulk, Star Wars, The Expanse, Buffy, Farscape. We've had a lot of great guest stars throughout, and even Star Trek. John DeLancey from Star Trek Next Generation was a guest star on one of our episodes as well.
Wow. Now, I got to tell you, the set is just incredible. This looks like really high budget to me. How did you said you did this through fundraising? I can't even imagine.
Well,
we
didn't build the sets through fundraising. What happened with the sets was this. I helped another fan production make an episode of their series, and we kind of became friends, and they had built a portion of the bridge. Mm-hmm. And when I decided that I wanted to make an episode of my own, I rented a facility down the street from where their bridge was, a much larger facility, and I had them, they agreed to move their bridge to the new facility, and then we all pulled our resources, whether it was labor or money or materials, and we built the whole rest of the soundstage. It's absolutely extraordinary. In fact, you know what? I would be remiss not to tell you, Martin, and to tell your listeners and your viewers, the man that took over the studio after we finished our series, Ray Tessie, makes it available for people to come and enjoy, to come and walk through the soundstage. You'll feel like you're 10 years old again, walking through the original Enterprise. It is euphoric.
Where is it located?
It's in Kingsland, Georgia. You fly into Jacksonville, Florida. But if you miss everything else that is said, NeutralZoneStudios.com. There is listed on that site open house dates where you can go and take a tour of the studio, sit in the captain's chair, step up on the transporter platform. And I love those sets so much because I helped build them and helped create them. I go down there myself personally and give people tours of the studio.
Oh,
so
really?
I'll be down there. I'll be down there on January 18th, coming up very soon. There'll be another open house in February and March. So we built the entire soundstage based on original floor plans. So what you're seeing on our series is, I would dare say, it's within inches of the original soundstage.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I actually touched the carpet that was in the original series. I was at I was in L.A. at an auction house that handles like things from props and things from different series and movies, and they had at the time he had Marilyn Monroe's dress, subway dress. I believe it sold for $600,000 or maybe even more. Maybe it was $2 million, or I can't even remember. But anyway, I saw rolled up when I was there. I was talking to Joe. I can't remember his last name. Magdalena or something like that. And I saw this rolled up jagged carpet, and I just pointed to it and I said, "What's that?" Anyway, because it was among all a bunch of Star Trek things. And he said, "Oh, that's the original carpet from the original series from the bridge."
Oh my goodness.
So I followed up and it sold for $11,000. So someone had to have it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But that's really, it's an amazing job you did with that, the sets. So really, really nice job.
Well, I would encourage you and anyone else who's a Star Trek fan, it's like dying and going to heaven. I got to tell you, there is nothing quite like it. And I don't know if you know this or not, Martin, but all of the rooms are connected to that bending corridor. They're all connected to the corridor. In other words, once you step into the corridor at one end and start walking down the corridor, you're on the ship. You can walk right into sick bay, right into the transporter room, right into the briefing room, right into the captain's quarters, climb the Jeffries tube. All of it is connected, so you feel like you're actually there. It is an amazing thing to see. And if you go to StarTrekContinues.com and you click on the on one of the tabs across the top on the word about, you'll find a 3D virtual tour of the studio where you can actually use arrow keys on your computer to cursor through and walk through and look all around and be able to see the studio.
Wow. We're going into a break here in just a couple of minutes, but have either one of you ever watched I have a friend, Roger Nygaard, and he made a film called, a documentary called Trekkies. Did you ever see that?
Oh, yes.
It's kind of like following this guy there, the super fans. Now, you mentioned earlier, have either one of you had encounters with a super fan that just...
Absolutely. In fact, I'll let you in on a little something, Martin. There was a young man that was in Trekkies who was the young boy who was really the super fan named Gabe Kerner. He was the one that outfitted his family's van to look like the shuttlecraft, and he was such a hardcore fan. Well, he grew up to become a special effects CGI guy, and he actually did some work on Star Trek Continues.
Oh, my God.
Yes, we've certainly encountered a lot of super fans.
And we got just a minute here. Mark, how about yourself? Have you had any encounters with super fans that, I mean, they can, you know, people can actually troll you these days when it comes to this subject, and I'm sure they do.
Oh, yeah, good and bad. Yeah. And, well, one, Gerald Gurian is, I think, the biggest collector of Star Trek props anywhere, and including the film trims from the editing room floors from the original series. And when I did my three-volume set, These Are the Voyages, Gerald contributed a lot of the pictures that are in these books, which were outtakes or alternate takes and things like that. So as you're reading about the making of the episode, you've got these pictures in there of those particular scenes that we're talking about, things of that nature. And you know, they're just terrific people. And when you look at all the technology that's come out of Star Trek, the inventions like the communicator and everything else, the communicator became the cell phone, and Spock's computer became the internet and the PC. And it was kids watching the show who grew up and said, why can't we have that? And invented that stuff. So even people who aren't fans of Star Trek, their lives have been impacted by Star Trek.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to get into that. All right, we're going to go into the break. All right, this is Martin Willis. I have my, oh my God, I hope I say his name right. We have
Mignogna.
Like tomorrow
Mark
in Spanish.
Cushman and Vic Mignogna. And we're going to be right back. I did it. Right after these messages. All right, we are back, and we are talking Star Trek. Mark, I want you, if you would, to go into the topic of These Are the Voyages and what kind of undertaking, as far as the amount of time and years and effort, did you have to put into that?
Oh, it was massive. Just like for Vic when he did the audiobook that's out now, which is 28 hours long and has a cast of 80 plus people. So he went through a great deal of work creating that audiobook, which is based on my books. That's why it took me so long to do it, because I first met Gene Roddenberry in 1982. When I interviewed him, and then again in 1989, I think, is when I pitched Sarek to him. And so I started collecting all these materials that he gave me access to at that point, tens of thousands of memos, production reports, everything, and we got the Nielsen ratings, as I mentioned, and I'd been interviewing. So I interviewed people over a period of 20 years, knowing that one day I was going to write these books. As soon as I had time, because I knew they were just going to be a huge job. And it was supposed to be one book, but it was just too much material, so we did one book for each season and a chapter for each episode. That's 10, 15, sometimes 20 pages long, like for The City on the Edge of Forever, because there were so many memos and so much back and forth over the writing of that script and then the production and so on. So as you're collecting all that material, you're going, oh, my God, this is going to take years to do. Well, it did. It took about a year per book once I actually started writing and putting all this material together. And so it was 20 years of research in my spare time and then 3 full years of writing to do these 3 books. And they came out 1 year apart, each one of them.
And how have they been received by the, I want to say, the real hardcore Trekkies?
Incredibly. They've sold well, and the we get letters all the time from people on how much they love them. But what really means a lot to me is the actual participants of Star Trek. I mean, Dorothy Fontana, she read all 3 of the books to give me notes to make sure
goodness.
I didn't get anything wrong. So DC Fontana is giving me notes. I'm putting her notes into the books on every script they made and so forth. And Bob Justman was giving me notes on the books, and John D.F. Black was giving me notes on the books. Gene had passed away at that point, wasn't able to get these done in time for him to see, but Rod loves the books, and Rod did the prologue for the audiobook. You know, all of them. Leonard Nimoy called me and said
they're...
Yeah, his quote was great because it just sounded like Spock on the phone, and he said, "Mark, these books are the research is astounding," and it was like Spock saying it. And Harlan Ellison called and blew me away, because I don't think Harlan's ever complimented anybody. You know, he's such a difficult person as far, he's so critical of other people's work. And he wrote, of course, the classic episode, City on the Edge of Forever. And he called me up, and I saw his name appear on my phone, and it was like, oh, God, because we just mailed him a copy of the book. And his interviews are in there with everybody else's. And I said, hi, Harlan. I think he was just going to rip me to pieces. And he says, Mark, I'm not going to say they're awesome, because that's a word I reserve for Eleanor Roosevelt and the Grand Canyon, but they come close. It was like I was trembling until he said that, and then there was this heavy sigh of relief, and he started laughing. I did not expect to get that from Harlan Ellison. But Judy Burns called up, and I introduced her to Vic, because she told me when I interviewed her for the Foley and Webb chapter, she said that if there had been a fourth season, they were going to do a sequel to that show. She'd had an idea and pitched it, and they all loved it because it went in a very unexpected direction. And she had been wanting to write that script. And I was working with Vic at that point on Star Trek Continues, giving him notes on scripts and so forth. So I called him up and I said, Judy's got a great story. And I pitched it to him, and he loved it. And so they got together, and she ended up writing. What was that one called, Vic?
Still Treads the Shadow.
Yeah. And it picks up where Tholian Webb left off, and very surprising direction that it goes. So it's a terrific episode of Star Trek Continues, and one of my favorites of the original series. So she called me up and said these should be required reading in all colleges that have screenwriting classes. Huh. Because when you read these things and you see the memos from Roddenberry and from NBC on every episode, including ones that never got made from a lot of very famous science fiction writers that they just couldn't afford to produce, or they were too edgy for television at that time. But when you read all these memos, it gives you a college course in how to construct a great story. And that's why when I was a kid and I sensed that this was like the best written show on TV, you read these memos and you see why. These people really cared, and they were all so bright, and they just understood about letting Kirk lead the story and about having a strong theme, an emotional theme, and conflict between the characters. And so it's a real education. And I asked Vic the other day if after he did the audiobook, if it had changed his feelings about the show when he watched it, if he appreciated it even more, being a great fan to begin with. And I'll let him tell you the answer he gave me the other day.
Absolutely. I was just blown away. In fact, to coin a phrase, fascinated by all of the information that went into that series. You know, Martin, you know the old saying, necessity is the mother of invention?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was never more true than in the making of Star Trek.
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you what. You know, everybody on the planet Earth, Martin, everybody on the planet Earth knows what you're talking about when you say, beam me up.
Yeah.
Beaming down.
Yeah.
And yet, when I read these books, I learned for the first time, do you know how they came up with the idea for the transporter, Martin?
No, I've heard a lot of different things, well, but not about that one.
Yeah. Let me tell you what it was. They couldn't afford to have the ship land on a planet every week. It just was, yeah. It was financially impossible to do the special effects required to make this giant ship land on a planet every week. Mm-hmm. So they came up with this idea where they could somehow get from the ship to the planet. They literally were just, you know, frantic to figure something out. And they needed to come up with a reason, with a way to save costs. And now the things that they came up with, and when you read the book, or better yet, listen to the book, when you listen to the book, what you find is that they came up with all of these iconic things and some of these amazing stories that we all remember so well, almost out of necessity. And originating ideas that are now part of our everyday vernacular. I was absolutely blown away by what it took for them to create each of these episodes.
I believe the memos in the book on that particular subject, Roddenberry came up with the idea, and in a memo, you know, he said, this will not only save us a lot of money and allow us to stay on budget, but it will get us into the story quicker. You can just open up the story, captain's log, and they step onto the transporter thing, and they're down there on the planet. And he said, this is going to be such a fast way to get to the action and get to the danger and get to the stuff to hook the audience before we go into the first commercial. And so, and I got another example right from what Vic was talking about, the Vulcan mind probe.
Yes.
Oh, man, it's amazing. That's in the first book, too, and so that's in the audiobook as well. They did an episode called Dagger of the Mind early in the first season, and it was about a guy, Simon Van Gilder, who escaped from a penal colony, and he gets aboard the Enterprise, and he's trying to tell them what has been happening down there, but he can't because he's been subjected to a neural neutralizer probe that prevents him from accessing these memories. And so in the script, Kirk's down on the planet, but in the script, Spock and McCoy hypnotize Van Gelder so that he can tell them what he's been trying to tell them, and it won't be blocked. And NBC, the memo's in the book, you can read it, it says, you know, you cannot do this. You cannot hypnotize somebody on the NBC television network because they were afraid. They were afraid people watching might become hypnotized if they saw a watch going back and forth like that. And Roddenberry wrote back to Stan Robertson at NBC, and he says, listen, we need to do this to make this story work. And he says, nope, it's against broadcast standards. So Roddenberry sat down, and he thought, well, how can we do this? And he said, I know. I'm going to have Spock touch Van Gelder's head and say, remember, or whatever he says, and get the words to come out. And then Spock is speaking the words for Van Gelder, telling about the neural neutralizer and whatever's going on down there, which is now happening to Kirk, who's down on the planet. And so it was stuff like that because they had to get around the sensor. And these are things I never even imagined. But when you go through the memos and you see all this stuff, it's my God, every episode was a battle.
I can totally believe that. I remember when Spock did that with that rock, living rock that was in the mine.
The Horta. That was the first episode I saw in reruns. Yes.
Oh, is that right?
And so that was done. That was done a couple months later. And if they hadn't come up with that device, plot device in that earlier episode, they wouldn't have been able to do the Horta episode.
Yeah, they found multiple episodes that followed opportunities to use the Vulcan mind meld. And you know what? You know what, Martin? The neck pinch.
Yes.
There was a script where an episode where the script called for Spock to punch somebody, and Leonard Nimoy was like, I don't think Spock would just punch people. He's not like a brute force kind of guy. So just like on the spot, they come up with these things that are now just like I say, they're part of our culture and everybody knows about them, but they were created in these moments of necessity.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, he was supposed to give the guy a judo chop, and Nimoy, they were on the set, and this was for The Enemy Within, which I think was the fourth episode they filmed of the series after the two pilots. And Nimoy said he just wouldn't do this. And Leo Penn was directing, the father of Sean Penn. And Nimoy's talking to Leo Penn and saying, you know, Vulcan would not do this, but, you know, I've got an idea. Vulcans know all about the human electromagnetic system and everything else, and they would know there's a pressure point between the neck and the shoulder blades where you could actually knock somebody out if you put pressure there. And Leo Penn says, oh, really? And he says, oh, yeah, it works. And he says, hey, Bill. And Shatner was on the set, but hadn't heard what they were even talking about. He says, Bill, come over here. And so Shatner walks over and he says, I was telling Leo about the Vulcan neck pinch, and he doesn't believe it, so I want to show him how it works. Do you mind if I do it to you? And Shatner says, no, go ahead. And Nimoy reaches over and squeezes his neck, and Shatner, without even knowing, this is how fast Bill Shatner is, without even knowing what the whole thing was about, but he caught on. He rolls his eyes up into his head, and he just collapses to the floor.
Beautiful.
And Leo Penn is, oh, that's incredible. Are you okay, Mr. Shatner? Are you all right? He's kind of a little groggy, but he says, yeah, I'm okay. And they help him up. And he says, oh, we got to do this. And so they filmed it that way. Well, the next day, Roddenberry and Bob Justman and John D.F. Black are in dailies watching the footage, and they see that. And there's a memo in the book for that episode where Gene Roddenberry writes Leonard Nimoy a letter and just tears him to pieces over it, politely but professionally, and says, you can never do this again. You don't know what we're writing for the next episode or the episode about that. You can't change a script like that after it's been approved by the network. And this letter goes on for about a page and a half, and he's just bringing Leonard Nimoy to task. And then the last line says, but we're going to keep this, and we're going to start putting in scripts. Sincerely, Gene Roddenberry.
Wow, amazing. I feel like I could talk about this forever and ever, and it's just so amazing. But one of the things I want to talk about right now, if it's all right with both of you, is the actors. Two, I think, are great luck. I saw the first pilot, and it's with a different actor, not William Shatner.
Jeffrey Hunter.
Yeah, and I think William Shatner did a much better job.
They all did.
Yeah, but also, he's amazing. He is 88 years old. He's still full of total energy. Someone I saw that, I forget who it was, that went to meet him, and he was like, still so full of energy at 88. When he was 80 years old, he rode across the country on a motorcycle. He's an amazing guy. And then Leonard Nimoy, oh, my goodness, when he passed away, I just saw that billboard that said he did, and you didn't even have to if you ever watched Star Trek, you know exactly what that meant. He lived long and prospered, and that must have been really exciting to talk to him. I've always thought, and there was a documentary out about his life. I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, I helped out on that. His
Oh, really?
Son Adam, directed and produced that, For the Love of Spock, I believe it's
right.
called.
Yes, great.
And I was a consultant on that because Leonard had Adam come call me, and so I get a phone call out of the blue from Adam Nimoy, and he says, my dad told me to call you because of the books you wrote. He says, you know Star Trek better than anybody, and you got all the memos and you got all this stuff, so would you help us with this thing? So, you know, I met with him, and I just, as a very minor thing, just was like a consultant for him. And I think it's a beautiful, beautiful movie. And Leonard was going to be part of that. They were doing that together. And Leonard passed away just days before they were going to shoot his interview segments.
So it kind of
stalled it for a bit. But then Adam said, "No, we're going to go ahead and finish it." And it's a wonderful show. If anybody hasn't seen it, For the Love of Spock.
Yeah, it's really good. And there's so many actors that were just amazing, and so many catchphrases you hear out there. You know, people will still. Like, you know, it's going to blow, Captain. You know, I mean, you know, there's just...
She can do no more.
That's right.
You know, and by the way, in Star Trek Continues, Scotty's played by Chris Doohan, James
yes.
Doohan's son, and he looks so much like his father.
Yes,
and
he
sounds
does.
So much like his father. It's amazing.
Yes. I didn't
but
realize
I
that's
tell
his
you,
son. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I did a... I was called in to do a thing for the History Channel, a 50-year anniversary. I did a three-hour show on Star Trek. And they called everybody in. Dorothy Fontana was in the makeup chair right before me, and she got interviewed, and then they brought me in, and then they brought in people after us, and we all did our little testimonial things, were answering questions. And I said something on that show. It just occurred to me. Mark Altman was behind the camera asking the questions, and he mentioned what you just did, Martin, about the cast and what it would have been like. And I said, you know, Star Trek was like the Beatles of TV in the 1960s. And if you had taken the four Beatles, and if you had taken any one of them out of the group, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, it wouldn't have been the same.
Mm-hmm.
It was just this magical grouping of four people that made that happen.
Bones.
And I said the same thing with Star Trek. If you took Bob Justman or Dorothy Fontana or Gene Kuhn or Gene Roddenberry out of the mix, it wouldn't have been the same show. And if you took William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, or James Doohan out, it wouldn't have been the same show. You know, it's just the caliber of talent and how they connected. It creates that magical thing that is hard to understand how it came about, but it's almost like fate.
Right. I'd like to talk about, if either one of you know, about how close Star Trek came to not happening. I mean, there was a lot of hurdles that had to be jumped over. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, I'll tell you how it got made. Lucille Ball was running Desilu. She and Desi started the studio with the money they had made from I Love Lucy reruns. And the reason they made the money is because back then all sitcoms were done live out of New York, and they would tape them off a TV screen on the West Coast to make a kinescope to air 3 hours later. And that's how they wanted to do I Love Lucy. But Desi and Lucy lived in L.A., and they wanted to stay there. So Desi said, let's do it on film with three film cameras in front of a studio audience. He invented that technique. And Harry Ackerman of CBS said, well, that's going to cost too much. And he said, I'll pay the difference if I can have the reruns. And I'm not joking. The response he got from CBS was, what's a rerun? There had never been one. Everything was live, and the kinescopes were not good enough quality to do it. I mean, you can look at those old honeymooners, and you see how bad they look for that very reason. And so after a couple years of being number one on CBS, they came to Lucy and Desi and said, we want to buy back the reruns, and gave them a few million dollars, and they used that money to buy RKO and turned it into Desilu Productions and started filming everybody else's shows, Andy Griffith, Dick Van Dyke, all those shows, but they didn't own them. And so after Desi was gone, Lucy was running reluctantly the president of Desilu, and she told her staff, bring me a show that could rerun as long as I Love Lucy is going to rerun. And they brought her Star Trek, Herb Solo and Oscar Katz brought her Star Trek. And she believed in it, and she was the champion. And her board of directors, even after NBC ordered a pilot, tried to talk her out of making it. And that was the one you mentioned, Martin, with Jeffrey Hunter. And they rejected it as being too cerebral, but they ordered another pilot, which had never happened before. And that first pilot cost $700,000,
wow,
which was just unheard
huge
of in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did the second one, Where No Man Has Gone Before, which cost about $500,000. And Desilu had to put up half the money. NBC put up half the money. And then NBC said, we'll take it. And they put in an order for 16 episodes, which back then was half a season. And again, the board of directors tried to talk Lucy out of doing it. They said it's going to bankrupt the studio. And she went with it anyway. Well, it
wow
did bankrupt the studio. And halfway through the second season, she had to sell Desilu to Paramount. And the first thing they did was they cut the budget to Star Trek. And Bob Justman, there's a memo in the third season book where he says, we're trying to do half a science fiction movie a week on the budget of a radio show. And that's why the third season isn't quite as good, generally speaking, as the first two. But there are still many, many excellent episodes in that third season, and it's still Star Trek, you know. But that it was a challenge to get it on because it was something that had not been done, and it was going to cost so much. And then it was a challenge to keep it on because the stories were too hot for NBC.
Interesting. Wow, totally amazing, Vic. As far as your production goes, did you have any big hurdles to get over, or how did that all work?
Oh, yeah, and I'll tell you something. One of the things that I that made me laugh when I read the books, when I recorded the audiobook for These Are the Voyages, I was amazed at how many things, how many hurdles and how many difficulties they had in making the original series that we had exactly the same. It was so funny. It sounded so familiar. There are always challenges in production, but if you consider, Martin, that you're bringing together a bunch of people and you can't... Star Trek is a licensed property, so you can't just make Star Trek and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't profit from somebody else's property. Now, that's not why we made Star Trek Continues. We made it to pay tribute to the series. We made Star Trek Continues out of love and to honor the original series, not to make a penny. Everybody coming into the production knew from the get-go. I sat everyone down ahead of time, and I said, now, we're going to have a lot of fun, and you're going to be a part of something very special, but there's no money to be made here.
Like zero?
Everybody know that right off the bat. But everybody was involved. And I got to tell you, for us to make 11 full-length episodes, I'm talking like hour-long, just like the original series, 11 full-length episodes across a 5-year run with 30 or 40 production people, and I could count on one hand the number of people that we lost along the way.
Wow.
Is unheard of. We had virtually no attrition. We had the same people. We very much became like a family. We had the same people come back twice a year, and we would make episodes together. We would descend on this wonderful little town in Georgia and spend 8 or 10 days there shooting an episode. And we had all of the challenges of a regular television show. And the funny thing was that you're not paying people tons of money, so you don't have any leverage. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can't say I'm going to dock your pay or I'm going to fire you and hire somebody else. You are basically at the mercy of the goodwill of everybody involved, the actors, the production people, everyone. You're hoping that they are as committed to this project as you are. And fortunately, they all were. And even though we did have a lot of challenges, we overcame them very much in the same way the original series production team did. And I'm so, so proud of everyone that worked on Star Trek Continues.
Yeah. I can't wait to watch it. I mean, I'm in the third episode and I'm hooked.
I can't wait for you to watch it. Like I told you, everyone just gets better and better and better.
Yeah. Yeah, and you do an excellent Captain Kirk, by the way.
Thank you.
You look a little bit like him.
Well, I love Bill Shatner so much, and Captain Kirk was a role model to me. I mean, like I mentioned earlier in your show, my mom and I moved into an apartment by ourselves. My dad was gone, and there was this guy on this show.
Mm-hmm.
He was handsome and strong and brave, and he went on these adventures, and he protected his friends, and Captain Kirk very much became a father figure to me. So when it came time to start this series and to play that character, it was a little scary because I wanted it so much to be good. I wanted so much to pay Shatner and Star Trek the tribute and the honor that they were due. So it was a big challenge, but the last thing I ever wanted would be for anyone to think that I was doing some kind of a satire, some kind of a parody of Kirk, like a lot of, you know, comedians will do the, you know, you don't know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, now, what about the hesitation? You're not doing
Well, you know what? I'll tell you, let me answer that. Here's what I will tell you about that, Martin. Whenever we would shoot an episode, I would take the first AD, the assistant director, I would take him aside and I would say, now listen, Scott, his name was Scotty Whitehurst. Scotty, if you see me doing too much Shatner, let me know.
Huh.
If I do too much, just let me know. And he did. And we would shoot a scene and he would pull me aside occasionally and he would say, there was a little too much that in there. And I'm like, okay, let's do it again. So my goal was to make people feel like they were watching the same characters, but not a parody of those characters, not a satire of those characters. You know, no offense to Chris Pine, but we don't need a reimagining of Captain Kirk. Shatner wrote the book. He is Kirk. I've spent enough time around him to know he is Captain Kirk. So my desire was not to reinvent or reimagine the character, but merely to pay homage to him and make our viewers feel like they were watching the same characters. Sure, their faces were a little different, and it's been 50 years, but most of our fans say that after 10 minutes – they feel like they're watching episodes that were locked in a vault somewhere for 50 years.
Yeah, that's what
and
the feeling is.
I can't imagine a better compliment than that.
Yeah, I agree with that comment. How about William Shatner himself? Has he ever given you any feedback?
Not specifically.
Yeah.
But I know that he knows about the show. I know that fans have told him about it. And like I said, I do a lot of voice acting work. So I've been I've been at many conventions with Bill as a signing guest. Mm-hmm. I would sign autographs based on a lot of the voice acting work that I've done, and Bill might be three or four tables down signing autographs.
Yeah.
And we have the same event manager. So consequently, we would get booked into a lot of events together. We've had dinners together. We've traveled together. And Bill knows how much I love and respect and admire him. So I think he knows. I had the chance to tell him that Star Trek Continues was literally a tribute to him and the others that made the original series. Because I know, Martin, that there are hundreds of thousands of people out there just like me who were so impacted by that show. They were so inspired and moved by that show. Mark touched on it earlier. People that went on to become engineers and teachers and scientists because of that show and those characters.
Right.
So I know that when we made Star Trek Continues, there were hundreds of thousands of people vicariously living through us. Beyond that, you know, show and be a part of that.
Yeah. Okay. We had a little bit of a Skype issue right then, but that's fine. Looks like it's okay.
No. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So I guess we can take it into break at this point. And this is a real break. We'll be right back in just a few minutes. Welcome back. This is Martin Willis, and I'm on with Mark Cushman and Vic Mignogna. And I think I said that right, or close. I'm trying. Maybe by the end of the show, I'll have it.
By the time it's over, you'll have it down.
That's right. Now, since we're coming back here, I told the listening audience that we might touch on the subject of UFOs, and there's no wrong answer here for either one of you, whatever you say. I just wondered, have you ever thought about the subject of UFOs? Has that ever intrigued either one of you? I don't know which one wants to go first.
I'm going to go first.
Go ahead, Vic.
I'm going to go first this time because it'll be short. I've always been intrigued by them, Martin. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I was young, when I was probably 12, 13, 14, I made a little flying saucer and I suspended it from a fishing line and I went outside. I went outside and I hung it, had a friend hold it in the air, and I took pictures of it, and it was a forced perspective thing because the thing was only this big, right?
Yeah.
But it was close to the camera, but it looked like it was hovering over the houses in my neighborhood.
My God, have you ever heard of Billy Meyer?
And I took pictures of it with a Polaroid land camera. And then I took those pictures to school and convinced half my school that it was actually. Oh my gosh, Mark! Do you know what I made? Do you know what I made the UFO out of? I made it out of a piece of the space station K7 from the Star Trek episode "The Trouble with Tribbles."
Oh, that's when the little thing, little balls of fur come down.
Yeah, the little saucer shaped. And the pictures looked so real that everybody they totally believed that I'd seen a UFO.
I actually wanted to talk about The Trouble with Tribbles. I love that episode. But anyway, that's pretty awesome. There's a guy named Billy Meyer. I don't know. Some people really believe in his work. But there's been a lot of speculations about that type of thing. Fishing pole and... to get some of the pictures he has. Creative.
Nowadays, the technology exists to allow you to, you could fake just about anything. But back when I did this, it was like the mid-70s, late 70s. So, you know, it was literally just hanging a model by a fishing wire and taking a photo of it.
Well, I'll just, before we move on to Mark, before we move on to him, I just want to tell you a quick story. I just mentioned Billy Meyer. Two, if I'm in the fine arts and antiques and auctions and stuff like that for my real life. And just recently at Sotheby's, four of his pictures sold, his early 1960s pictures of flying saucers sold for over $20,000. Oh, we're talking about photographs.
Gracious.
Did you save your Polaroid?
You know what? I'll bet it's in a drawer at my mother's house somewhere right now.
That could be a funding for your next project.
Wouldn't
all right.
That nice?
Mark, what about you? Have you ever contemplated the topic of UFOs?
Oh, all the time. I completely believe in it. I've seen a lot of specials and movies and videos on it and so forth, and there's just so many things out there that are hard to explain, almost impossible to explain. And when I was on that dairy farm as a boy up near Tillamook, Oregon, I saw what I believed was a UFO, and I can't say if it was saucer-shaped or not because there was so much light coming out of it that I couldn't really discern the exact shape, saucer, round, something, but it just was immense light and no sound whatsoever, silent. And we were surrounded by mountain ranges. I mean, as I said earlier, we couldn't get Channel 8 out of Portland. This was a very back area, where we had a 160-acre dairy farm in Timberland. And I saw this thing for a couple minutes just hovering over one of our pastures. And out there, by the way, the sky is just filled with stars because it's no city. And the climate up there in Oregon, where I grew up, and so this thing was just illuminating. It was incredible, and yet it was so eerie because there was no silence, and then it just went and went off like a streak, and it was gone. And this was when I was about 9 or 10. So ever since then, I've been into it, and I've been read about it and watched it and listened to shows like yours, Martin, and so forth. And you know, when you look at, we were talking about Star Trek, you know, when Gene submitted the original proposal for the series to Desilu and then to NBC, the first page or two is just mathematical equations of the probability of planets out there that could have life on them, and if only one out of a billion supports life, and if only one out of a billion of those has life that evolves to intelligence, there would still be 20 million billion planets that could have life. I'm making these numbers up, but they're like that. I mean, the numbers are just immense in this proposal that he submitted. And they did a great UFO episode in Star Trek that Dorothy Fontana wrote, Tomorrow is Yesterday, where the Enterprise is thrown back in time. They were on their way to Earth, and they, Vic could probably tell us the reason why. It was something about the magnetic pole of the sun or something, and it whipped them around. And so they arrive at Earth, but nobody's responding to their hailing frequencies. And then we go down on Earth, and we see the jets being scrambled because the Enterprise has been spotted as a UFO. And so they've ended up in, like, 1967 Earth, and the jets are pursuing the Enterprise. A terrific episode.
Yeah.
They have to beam the pilot aboard because the plane's cracking up. They put it in a tractor beam, and it starts to break up. So they beam the pilot aboard the Enterprise, and he's confronted with this thing from 300 years in the future, and a Vulcan, and everything else. So they have to figure out a way to get him back and destroy any evidence, any of the film from his plane that got shots of the Enterprise and stuff like that. So they were all into it, of course. And, you know, all the scripts from Star Trek went over to NASA and the RAND Corporation and so forth, and they got feedback on everything they did. And Gene Roddenberry said, look, I'm not asking that the stuff we do is probable, but I want to know that everything we do in this show is possible. Mm-hmm. And so all that stuff went through. And again, you see a lot of those memos and those notes in the books as well. So that's why that show rang true. Where the other science fiction shows didn't, is because NASA was so into that show and they were so hooked on it. When they did Star Trek the Motion Picture, NASA loaned them, they made two Voyagers. One was a mock-up and the other one was the one they sent off into space. And in that episode, they encountered Voyager returning to Earth.
V'ger.
And V'ger, which is V'ger in the movie because some of the letters are rubbed out. Right. And NASA loaned them the Voyager mock-up. So when you watch Star Trek the motion picture, that's the actual mock-up for the Voyager space probe. So they were into it. I've got these, real quick, I continued with a series of these books. These are the Voyages, and I've got a fourth one out now and a fifth one coming out in a few months, which take care of the 70s, which is the animated series, the aborted Phase 2 series and Star Trek the motion picture, but also the coming of the conventions and the growing of the fan base and everything that was happening during that decade. And there was a part of it that just gives me chills. It'll be in the fifth book that'll be out in the spring, that Roddenberry was hired by a group out of New York called The Nine, and they put him with a channeler who was speaking for aliens who had visited Earth and were preparing to come back, and they were recruiting people like him to help prepare us for the return. And they wanted him to write a movie that would help prepare us, and they felt Star Trek had done really good in that area as well. So the aliens were watching Star Trek, you know? And I have the transcripts, and I put a big chunk of that in the book. And it's the questions he asks are just incredible, and the answers that he's getting from the channeler are fascinating. You may be aware of it, of that research and everything, Martin, but it was all new to me, and I had chills as I was going through this stuff.
Yeah, no, never heard of it. Isn't that amazing? Huh.
I'll send you the book, and you can read all about it.
Yeah, okay. Wow. Wow, that's great. Now, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about the pop culture and the things that were going on. I mean, right away, I noticed in the very first episode of Star Trek where there's this blonde lady that comes on board with his 5 o'clock report, and right away, Kirk goes, "Oh, I'm just not used to a woman being here." And a woman was a second officer on board, but there was a lot of 1960s overture that you know, kind of went right into that film. And you talked about miniskirts and but what do you think of the how that has evolved? I mean, you don't really carry it on.
Yeah, I think that it's undeniable that Star Trek, that the original series of Star Trek pioneered new ground in a lot of areas, whether it be scientific, which is self-evident, and then also in terms of like Mark even mentioned, like race relations and gender, you know, male female roles and things like that. I think the original series did a great deal to move the dial forward, so to speak, in presenting new ideas and breaking some stereotypes and molds of the time.
Yeah.
And I cover a lot of this in the books as well, because I have to. What these books do is they take you back in time. You're not reading about what happened back there. You're going back. Because when you see these memos all put together, cut together sections and everything, you feel like you're sitting in a room listening to Stan Robertson from NBC and Gene Roddenberry and Gene Coon and Dorothy Fontana and Bob Justman all sitting around talking about this week's episode that we're about to produce and the script and everything else. So you're in the room, you're a fly on the wall watching the show being created and watching the show through its lifespan. And so part out of all that, some of the things that I can share with you just quickly is in the first pilot, which you had noted, Martin, starred Jeffrey Hunter as Captain Pike. First of all, they wanted William Shatner, but he was not available. He was the top of the list. Oh. And they just knew he was the guy. Roddenberry knew Shatner was the guy. But Bill Shatner was doing For the People, a TV series that he had on CBS. And after they did the first pilot, Jeffrey Hunter backed out because he was under contract to do 5 seasons if the pilot sold. But NBC rejected it and ordered a second pilot, and that was a loophole for him to get out because he was offered a movie role. So he said, "I'm going to go do that instead." And right at that moment, Bill Shatner's series got canceled. Mm. And Roddenberry called Shatner, and he flew out, and he showed him the pilot. And Shatner said, you know, he's playing the character a little too mellow, a little too intellectually mellow. And I think a captain of this ship has to be a really ambitious guy to get to that position. And he has to have that energy that you would follow him up into anything. And so Shatner brought, and like Vic was saying, Shatner really kind of co-created the character Kirk. But the in the first pilot, the second in charge of the Enterprise was number one, who was a female. But NBC felt that maybe the audience won't be ready for this. So they made Spock second in charge. We couldn't have a woman, but we could have a Vulcan.
Mark, I remember something from your book that you wrote, Mark. In the book, you wrote how NBC basically called Roddenberry and they said, you can have the pointed ear guy, or you can have the woman, but you can't have both.
They had a lot of concerns.
They said we'll let you keep one of them, but not both of them. And Roddenberry now, and I know Mark was probably going to tell you this, and I'm sorry for stealing your thunder, Mark, but the number one, the woman from the original pilot, was Gene Roddenberry's wife, Majel Barrett, and he. In the book, it explains how Roddenberry felt so strongly about keeping the Spock character that he had to tell his wife that her character was going to be gone.
Did they stay married?
Yes.
But they actually were not married at that point. She became Gene's second. Yeah, she became his second wife, but she was his mistress at that moment. Yes. Okay. And he said, I promise I'll give you another role. And he created the role of Nurse Chapel for her. And she was also the voice of the Enterprise computer at the same time. So she had two roles in the series, but she didn't get the role that he wrote for her in the pilot. Yeah, NBC was worried about if the audience would be accepting of a female second in charge, when the captain's in jeopardy, she's in charge of the ship. It was just a little ahead of the time there, and they were also worried about Spock's character. He looked too satanic, and they didn't think the Bible Belt especially would go for that character. And so they kind of told Gene, we're not going to let you do both of these things. It's just, you know, you're going to challenge the audience too much in two different ways, so you got to pick. And he said, well, I got to pick the Vulcan. You know, and I'll take my lumps at home. But the miniskirt came from Grace Lee Whitney and Nichelle Nichols. They were supposed to be wearing slacks, and they both were dancers. They had great legs. They wanted to show the legs off. So they said, why can't we be wearing skirts? And so they created the skirt outfit, and they were the ones who kept raising the hem, saying, you know, can't it be a little higher? It'd be more comfortable. It'd be more practical if it was higher. And so that was America's first look at the miniskirt. But, you know, to give your audience kind of a reference point, 1 year earlier, I Spy premiered, and that was the first show that had, and I did a book about that show too, that was the first show about a white and a black sharing equal billing in a TV show, and a non-stereotypical role for the black as well. And so the very next year, Star Trek goes on with an interracial cast, and women at controls too in the future. And so we can look at it now and say it's a little sexist, or it's not, you know, as politically correct as some people want everything to be now. But for 1966, when that show premiered, it was pushing the barriers in every direction that you can imagine.
That makes sense. I can see that. Yeah. You know, when you really reflect on the whole thing in general, what were some of the other kind of things that came out of Star Trek that you're aware of, either one of you?
Well, I'll toss in a few and Vic can tell you whatever I don't mention, what I forget. But the communicator is the obvious one, because the guy who invented the cell phone for Motorola based its design and its concept on Captain Kirk's flip-open communicator. They all carry them on Star Trek. And Bill Gates and some of the other wizards who came up with the Internet and the PCs and everything, you know, they've made statements in the past about, you know, they were kids watching Star Trek and thinking, geez, if I could only have all the information of the world at my fingertips. And why can't I have what Spock has? Another one, the minute I say this, it's going to pop into your head, Martin, and your audience as well, is Bluetooth. I mean, picture the bridge of the Enterprise. Uhura's
oh, yes.
got that Bluetooth in her ear, and Spock quite often has one, too.
The big chrome thing out of his ear.
The first time we saw... Yeah. You know, the first time we saw CDs, DVDs was on Star Trek. The first time we saw MRIs were on Star Trek. Automatic opening doors where you didn't have to step on a mat like we had to in the 1960s, but they sensed you coming. All this stuff came from Star Trek. It's funny. I think most of our technology either comes from the military. Even the Frisbee came from the military. Either came from the military or came from Star Trek. And Star Trek was not copying the military. They were getting these ideas from guys from NASA. The military actually came down to Desilu in 67 when Star Trek was finishing up its first season and going into its second, and wanted to take pictures of the bridge and examine the bridge and everything else because they thought that would be a great design for bridges on aircraft carriers and things of that nature.
Wow.
So they were coming to Star Trek to say, we want to copy what you're doing.
Isn't that amazing?
Also,
what did I forget?
also, the bio beds. If you remember in the sick bay, there was a little sensor that stuck out of the wall above the bed, and whenever somebody laid down on the bed, the display would light up, and it would give you all their vitals. Well, I remember reading an article just maybe a year ago. That technology has been developed now, or is in development, which is basically that same kind of a bio readout bed, and referencing Star Trek again. The data tapes that in Star Trek were just flat little square tapes. Well, 20 years later, they were floppy disks.
Right.
So yeah, they were way ahead of their time.
And what about, you know, the warp speed, warp drive? I mean, you hear that used so often today. That didn't, you know, this is a real layman speaking here. That term was never used before Star Trek, or was it?
No, I don't believe so. We saw it in a few movies like Forbidden Planet and some books from Heinlein and whatever. They would call it hyperdrive. And that's what they called it on Lost in Space, too, which premiered in 65, 1 year before Star Trek. It was hyperdrive. Warp, it's funny. Again, in these books, you see a lot of these memos from the scientists and so forth. I didn't use a lot of that because my publisher was saying these books are too big. We got to crunch them down. And so being a dramatic writer, I wanted to leave in the memos from the creative staff and the fights with NBC and the stuff where you got conflict, because conflict's the name of the game in anything you do. So a lot of the technical stuff came out. But I do have a lot of it in the book that will be out in the spring, because for Star Trek, the motion picture, they had a fella assigned to them from NASA, who went through all the scripts like they did with the first series, but he would send very detailed memos, and there were quite a few talking about warp drive and about the wormhole and everything else. And so they were getting all this from scientists. And the reason we didn't see that in other shows is because the other shows didn't have the support of NASA and JPL and the RAND Corporation and things like that. Roddenberry made it just made sure that all the story outlines, the scripts, everything went to these people, and they could get the feedback to make Star Trek as believable as possible. They'd fudge it here and there, like in space, when the Enterprise flies by the camera and you hear a whoosh. Well, he got a memo from one of them. They said, you know, there is no sound in space.
Right.
You're not going to hear a whoosh. And he said, yeah, but. It's so much more dramatic, so we got to put that in there. And but most of the stuff they did, the scientists looked at it and said, no, 300 years from now, we think that would absolutely be possible.
Yeah, right about the noise in space. It's still used no matter what. I mean, they still use it today and any type of space, you know. And it always comes to mind when I see that and you hear the noise, like, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, you'd never hear that. But
yeah,
but I get it.
Dramatic license. I mean, you watch the footage without that whoosh sound, and it just doesn't quite have the.
That's
impact.
Right. Yeah.
You know what's kind of interesting, Martin, is that so many sci-fi TV shows and movies put sound effects of spaceships and space battles in outer space. So many of them use sound that every once in a while, a movie will come along and it will not. It will be dead silent in space, and it's actually kind of creepy because we are so used to hearing spaceships fly by and so used to seeing lasers and hearing laser beams firing in outer space that when a film comes along and goes, you know what, we're going to go dead silent whenever we're in outer space, it actually is dramatic because we're so used to the other way.
Yeah, now it's dramatic. Yeah, it's surprising.
Exactly.
And when you were asking me before about UFOs, Martin, and I told you about that thing in Oregon over the field, I mean, that was the thing that struck in my mind even more than the brightness.
I say that all the time about my sighting. I've talked about my sighting many times in the show. I won't bore the listener. But that was the most dramatic thing for me as well, was how can this thing be moving and there's absolutely no sound, which is such a puzzle.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Martin, I'd love to get the chance to talk about the audiobook a little bit if we could.
Yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
This audiobook is extraordinary. As you know, I'm sure you've listened to audiobooks before. Mm-hmm. They're usually one guy. Right, there's usually one narrator doing the whole book, but when I was getting ready to attack this monstrous project, and as Mark mentioned, the books are very, very large, very long. I thought, well, you know, there are hundreds of people that speak in this book, hundreds of people, and I didn't want to have to do all the different voices myself. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, wouldn't it be really much more fun to listen to if we brought other people in to be the voice of Gene Roddenberry and the voice of Dorothy Fontana and the voice of Leonard Nimoy and all of the people, so that you as the listener would feel like you're actually sitting there listening to the actual people who did it tell you in their own words, their own memos and their own stories. We brought in people from the original series who were still alive. Dorothy Fontana came in and recorded her own excerpts. Joe DiAgosta, the casting director, came in. Clint Howard, Bobby Clark, people that were part of the original series came in. And then if some of the people were passed, like Leonard Nimoy had passed by this point, his son Adam came in and did his dad's excerpts, and Chris Duhon did his dad's excerpts. And then I brought in a lot of Star Trek Continues production crew and cast to be the voices of their counterparts. So like Jerry Finnerman was the director of photography for Star Trek. Well, Jerry Finnerman has passed away. And like nobody probably knows what Jerry Finnerman really sounded like anyway, because he wasn't an on-camera actor. Mm-hmm. So I had Matt Busey, our director of photography for Star Trek Continues, be the voice of the director of photography for Star Trek. And the way the audiobook has been produced, I'm the voice of the narrator and the voice of Mr. Shatner and the voice of a handful of small roles. But every time one of the major players, whether it's Oscar Katz or Herb Solo or Alexander Courage or Bob Justman, anytime they speak, you hear a different person speaking, and it makes you feel like you're literally sitting in a room with the creators of Star Trek, and they're telling you their stories in first person. Even the people that have read the book absolutely loved the book. Even though they'd read the printed book, they loved listening to the audiobook. It was like it was all new again.
Isn't that something? Wow. And that sounds like an editing nightmare to me.
Oh, it was. It was. And you know what? I mean, if I had done the book by myself, I probably could have read it and finished it in a couple of months at the most. But having this lame-brained idea to bring in all of these other people, like Mark told you early on, 80, Martin, 80 different people are in this book. For me, when I had that idea, I effectively quadrupled my workload.
Oh, absolutely.
And it took me a year to put it all together.
A year. I wonder if anyone's ever put that kind of time in an audiobook before.
I don't know.
That might
but
be
a lot,
record.
You know what? It went, as with Star Trek, as with Star Trek Continues, it went way beyond money. Because, you know, for me, it wasn't about, you know, how much money am I being paid for this? It was about, this is Star Trek. This is the thing that I loved since I was a little boy. This is the thing that I created a web series for. What a privilege to be a part of that series like this. So I spent the time and the effort willingly because of my love for the series.
Wow.
And we finally got him to read the book.
Getting back
I said, Vic, you know, Vic, you're always flying somewhere. Here's a great book to take on the plane. But when Vic is on a plane, he's editing. He's doing stuff on his laptop. So he doesn't have time to sit down and read a 500-page book, which is just
Mark, I said, Mark, I'll listen to the audio book. And he said, there is no audio book.
there is now.
Wow. I do have a question for you, Vic. When you were creating this web series and had to have all this money involved, are you allowed to make money to pay expenses and not to earn money on something like that?
The money that you raise can go for the hard expenses. For instance, when we made the first episode, Pilgrim of Eternity, I paid for the airfares. I paid to fly everybody to the studio. And then you got to put them in hotels, right? Mm-hmm. So somebody's got to pay for them. The hotel people, they may even be Star Trek fans, but they're still going to charge you for the rooms.
Yeah.
And everyone has to eat every day. So there are, and then you have dolly rentals and camera tripods and hard drives and makeup supplies, and there are hard costs associated with putting something like this together. So you're allowed to pay those, but a singular person like an actor or a makeup person or a wardrobe person is not allowed to make a profit off of something like this. And that is the real beauty of it, if you think about it. I have to tell you,
he got professionals, people, Hollywood professionals, to work on the show who were Star Trek fans, like Doug Drexler, who's done the special effects for Next Generation and a couple of the other series, a lot of the movies. He would do the Enterprise, you know, shots and things of that nature. He came and did all the shots for the Enterprise on Star Trek Continues, which is why it looks so damn good.
And you know what, Martin? I was living in LA for a while, and when I would tell people at studios there what I was doing, the first question out of their mouths was always, well, how are you making money?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I would look at them like, seriously? Mm-hmm. Is that really what your world revolves around? Is it such a foreign concept to you that somebody would do something out of pure love and passion? You know, there are some things that are greater than money, and some things that money can't buy. And one of the most beautiful things about Star Trek Continues and all these fan productions is that people made them out of pure passion and love for the series, not because they were going to make $1 million or they were going to be famous or they were going to bank a big paycheck, but because they really loved the material. And like Mark said, we had professionals working on our series, and none of them were paid anything because they did it because they loved Star Trek and they wanted to be a part of it. And that was extraordinary. It's incredibly rare.
That is. I can't think of any other situation where that would happen right off the bat.
Not usually, no.
Yeah. Well, it was like when Vic asked me to do a script for the show. You know, it was not a paying job. But I had lots of other paying jobs. I've written hundreds and hundreds of scripts in my life and my career. So, you know, I did a couple script assignments, and then I blocked off 2 weeks. And instead of taking a vacation, I wrote Divided We Stand. And I had more fun writing that script because I always wanted to write a script for the original series. Everybody at Next Generation wanted to write scripts for the original series. Everybody there was a fan of the original series. And it was difficult because by this point in his life, Gene Roddenberry decided that if we are going to survive 100 years beyond the original Star Trek, man has to get rid of his petty differences. And so there wasn't very much conflict between the characters in the other Star Trek shows. And so all the writers down there were thinking, man, we wish we could be writing for Kirk, Spock, and McCoy and have conflict, you know, and teasing each other and doing things like that. So when I got to write Divided We Stand, it was better than taking a vacation for me.
And by the way, Martin, that is the fifth episode. So you'll be coming up on that pretty soon. And you'll remember that Mark wrote that story. But, you know, with no conflict, there's no story. In any book you read, any movie you watch, any television show, if you have no conflict, you have no story. So think about it. If 300 or 400 years from now, everything's just hunky-dory and everybody just all gets along, what do you write about? So there has to be conflict in order for there to be a story.
Wow.
That was a very interesting point that Mark made.
I'm going to be
I do that with the books too. As I mentioned earlier, I didn't lay heavy on the scientific memos. I sprinkled them in so you can see that he had that support and NASA was really into it. There was a great picture in the book too of all the people in NASA at their control stations for one of the Apollo flights, and they're all wearing Spock ears. Every one of them. They were fans. But I knew my screenwriting instincts, what I brought into these books was this is a very dramatic story. How it got on the air, how it stayed on the air, the fights with the network, everything else, and the fights with production. How are we going to take this script and turn it into reality? How can we afford to do this? And fortunately, they wrote such colorful memos, Bob Justman in particular, and he could have been a stand-up comic. His memos were so funny when they were trying to do the episode The Doomsday Machine, which they did do. He didn't want to do that one, and he wrote memos to Gene Kuhn and Gene Roddenberry saying, if you don't cut this assignment off, I'm going to start sending you my psychiatrist bills and things like that, because he had to take this script and find a way to realize it. And so the conflict with those characters in that show and the type of stories they were writing and the conflict behind the scenes makes this an engaging read. Some people, because of the size of the books, will refer to them as reference books, which always offends me because they're not. They're a very dramatic read. And so much so that when they were published, ICM, one of the bigger agencies in Hollywood, contacted me to see if the screen rights were available. Because they said, this would make a good series, a series about the making of a series with all the drama that's in there.
All right.
Unfortunately, you need CBS's permission.
I would like to be able to take calls now, if that's possible.
Oh, great.
I do not have a call screener. We're not live on the radio, so I don't have a call screener. So they'd be coming in live. So that number is up on the screen on YouTube, 603-967-4030. Now, I'm going to ask you the dreaded question you don't want to be asked, and I don't want to hear, they're all like my babies to me, but anyway, I'm going to ask you, what was your favorite episode of the first original series? I'm going to start out, when I was a kid, I loved things like guinea pigs and hamsters and stuff like that, so I loved The Trouble with Tribbles. I just remember, as a kid, you know, I love that one, but there were so many more that were really interesting, like the time travel one when they go back, when Joan Collins is in it and all that. But I'm going to ask you the dreaded
question. Can I say something about Trouble with Tribbles, Martin?
Yeah, go ahead.
David Gerald, when I interviewed him for the book, you know, he told me that every episode of Star Trek had a strong theme, and the theme of that episode is overpopulation. And he had pet hamsters and pet rats and stuff when he was a kid, but you got to be careful not to put a male and a female in the same cage or you're going to have a lot of little rats. And so that got him the idea of what would happen if these cute little critters that are harmless or seem harmless start breeding on the Enterprise, and then it's not harmless anymore. They're eating up your food reserves. They're just causing them. They're getting into the machinery, and so even the most benign creature can be a problem if you don't control population growth.
Isn't that something?
To where you can handle it.
We have a call.
So, Vic, why don't you tell him your fave?
Well, before we get into that, we do have a caller, and I'm sorry again, I don't have a screener, so I have no way to put these on hold for a long time. Caller, you're on the line. What's your name? Where are you calling from? Your first name? Caller, are you still there? I think they may have dropped off. So if they call back in. Yep, it shows that they're some type of noise here. It hung up or something. They're trying again, so let's give this another try.
Sure.
Welcome to the show, caller. Your first name and where are you calling from? It did this last week to a New York number. Wouldn't take the call. I was having trouble with Skype. I should have used Zoom. And it may be just an issue. It did this last week because I wasn't on the radio show as well. So why don't we go ahead into Vic. What's your... who's your favorite child?
My favorite episode was a very obscure episode in the third season called Requiem for Methuselah. It was about this the Enterprise was there was an epidemic on the Enterprise and they needed this substance to make an antidote for it, and they go to this planet and there's this older gentleman living alone on the planet, and they beam down and they meet this man, and then they find out that he has this daughter, and Kirk of course falls in love with the daughter, and then you find out over the course of time that this older man is in fact all of these famous men throughout history. He's immortal, and he was Moses and Socrates and Da Vinci and Brahms and throughout history. And what I loved the most about that episode was that at the very end of the episode, you see Captain Kirk as you've never seen him in the whole rest of the series. And that was ashamed of his behavior.
Wow.
You see Captain Kirk literally embarrassed about the way he behaved.
And distraught.
Yeah, as a little kid, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, he's a normal, flawed, flesh and blood human just like we are. He's not the perfect hero who always does the right thing and always has the answer. He screwed up and he knows it, and he really regrets it. And that really impacted me so much so, Martin, that our fourth episode, which you're going to be watching soon, I hope, discusses that very, very same thing. It shows a side of Kirk that has a lot of regrets and shame, unfinished business with people from his past. And it was the impetus for episode four was that final scene in Requiem for Methuselah. For me, that's my favorite episode, and that's why.
Wow. Before we get into yours, thank you for that. That's really, I don't recall that in particular. It sounds familiar, but I just don't recall that. But for someone that kind of displays a huge ego, as Kirk seems to, that I can understand why that would make an impact. We are having an issue with Skype. We had several people trying to call in, and it would not join any of them. So we're going to skip the phone calls tonight, I'm sorry to say. And I do appreciate those people who have tried to call in. I really do appreciate you trying. We'll be back to our radio station with this call screener next week. So go ahead, Mark.
My favorite, and there's so many. Journey to Babel is a great episode. Doomsday Machine, Shore Leave. For real fans of the show, they know the titles. But my favorite is This Side of Paradise, which Dorothy Fontana wrote. And in that episode, they beam down to a planet. They came to rescue, if anybody's alive, these settlers, but they're not expecting anybody to be alive because they found out there's a certain radiation that's been hitting the planet. And they're surprised to find that people are still there and healthy and happy. But the reason they are is because there's these spores that have taken over their bodies, not taken over their minds, but taken over their bodies so that they are protected from the radiation, and it gives the spores a body to live in. Well, when the spores hit you, your anxiety goes away, your troubles go away, and you become, and it was kind of like a commentary on drugs from that era. And Spock gets shot by the spores, and he falls in love with Jill Ireland. And the entire crew abandons the ship, and Kirk is left all alone on the ship. He's been shot by the spores too, but he doesn't give in to them because he's such a driven man. He is imperfect. He's swaggering, commanding, driven, ambitious in every way possible. And so he fights off the spores, and they can't get an edge on him. But he's got to get his crew back, and the person he needs the most is Spock. And he's the only one left on the ship who can beam Spock back. So he figures he's got to find a way to get Spock angry so that he can get rid of the spores through anger, which is the thing that kept Kirk from being subjected to them. And so he does it, and there's a fight in the transporter room and everything else. But at the end of the episode, it's so poignant because Spock looks sad. And Kirk looks at him and says, you know, are you okay? And he says, Captain, for the first time in my life, I was happy.
Wow.
And, oh, Jesus. I mean, I just got a little crack on my voice when I tried to say the line because it's so emotional. It's a great Kirk story, losing his entire crew. And he says, I never realized how big this ship was. He's recording a captain's log, and he's all alone on his ship. It's a great story for Spock because he falls in love. And for the first time in his life, he was happy, and he lost it, and so forth. It's just, these are the type of stories they told on that show that that I've never seen on any other TV show, science fiction or anything else. And that's what hooked me on this series.
I do remember that. I do remember that particular one. How do you think the show itself, when it was in production and, you know, became semi-popular or popular? You were saying that it was actually popular during the, you know, when it was being the first out, the first run. But how did it affect the people's lives, the actors' lives, as far as everyday life? Did you ever find any of that out?
Immensely. Sure. Because I interviewed them, but also I have the memos, and even they were writing memos. Nimoy would write a lot of letters to Roddenberry about episodes they were getting ready to film and things of that nature. And but, you know, it had an audience of between 15 and 20 million people a week on NBC.
Amazing.
The first episode that aired on the network had a rating of an audience share of 47.5%. 47.5% of the TVs in America were watching Star Trek that night. Does that sound like a failure? They didn't all do that well, but quite often, as I said, it'd be winning its time slot. So they had like 20 million people a week watching that thing. It became even more popular in the 70s, running five nights a week in every city across America, where it was beating network shows and so forth. And also in the new book, you read about NBC trying to get it back 2 years after they canceled it. And Paramount won't give it back to them because they've destroyed all the sets. They've given the Enterprise to the Smithsonian Institute, the 12-foot model. And they're thinking, you know, if you don't give us a two-year commitment, we're not going to rebuild all this stuff. And that was what was keeping it off TV in the 1970s, which none of us knew about. But Nimoy was the most affected because he had, and everybody told me this, and Vic, you got a story you got to tell. I'll be done in a second, and I'll throw it over to you if we have time. But Nimoy had to play this character who was blocking his emotions. And every actor I interviewed, all the guest stars, everybody who would come through the show would say the same thing, that he would be so friendly and everything, but in makeup, the minute they started putting the makeup on, he just became Spock. And you could not get him to smile or laugh. They were always trying, and there are a few pictures in my books and a few that you might find on the internet where you see Spock with a big grin on his face, because Shatner in particular was always trying to get Nimoy to laugh, always trying to crack him up. But he became that character. And after the show was over, the first series, he wrote a book called I Am Not Spock, which is not a put-down mm-hmm. on the show at all, like the title makes you think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's talking about what he learned from that character, and for the rest of his life, and he told me this as well, for the rest of his life, he would have conversations with himself. If he was ever wondering, what should I do, he would, without speaking, in his mind, he would say, Spock, what do you think I should do here?
Oh, my God.
And then Spock would say, Leonard, I think you should do this. So it became another side of his personality, which he kept into him for the rest of his life and utilized for the rest of his life. But, Vic, you got to tell the story about, you know, you hear George Takei always taking shots at Shatner and stuff like that. And after Vic did the audiobook, and so which got him to read the book, and he saw all these interviews I did with all these guest actors and even the regular cast and even Takei back then, what he had to say, and so forth. Vic, share that story with what you told William Shatner.
As I was reading the book, I was really struck by how just everybody, Martin, everybody in the book talked about how extraordinary Shatner was. They talked about what a great actor that he was. They talked about how affable he was, that when they were on set, he was so full of energy, and he would crack people up and make jokes and make you feel so at home. And then the cameras would roll and he would be right there with Captain Kirk. But he would come up with ideas and he would bounce around and demonstrate ideas. Even guest stars talk about in Shore Leave when he fought the character Finnegan, who was a friend of his from his Academy days. Mark interviewed the actor who played Finnegan, and he talked about how Shatner and he choreographed this fight. And Shatner, who's the star of the show, and this other guy is just an episodic actor, a day player. And Shatner choreographed certain fight moves so that the other guy would get more screen time. And there were so many stories where everybody that talked about Shatner talked about what a consummate professional he was and how great he was and funny and energetic and supportive. So about a year and a half ago, I was signing autographs at a convention, Florida Supercon, actually. And I was in the green room, and Bill came in. He was signing that weekend as well. Bill and Gary, our manager, came in, and the two of them sat down at a table. And I walked over, and I sat down beside Bill, and I put my arm on his shoulder, and I said, I'd like to tell you a story that I think will really encourage you. And Bill looked at me and said, do I look like I need encouragement, Vic?
Sounds like something he'd say.
And I said, he said, I'm just kidding. And I said, let me tell you, I'm reading this audiobook. And I said, I want you to know that everybody that was interviewed for this book, the guest stars, crew people, other actors, production people, all talked about how amazing you were, how kind, how funny, how supportive, how energetic, how brilliant you were. And I said, so now in today's period where there are people kind of rewriting stories, you know what I mean, and taking shots at him, and there's some conflict and rivalry between some of the actors. I said, I just thought that would encourage you, Bill, to know that the dozens and dozens of people that I read about who worked with you in this series all had nothing but the most glowing things to say about you. And he turned to me and he put his arm on my shoulder and he said, that does encourage me, Vic. Thank you. Thank you for telling me that. He said, you know, after all, a lot of the things that have been said over the years, that really means a lot to me.
Wow.
And it was really a great privilege to be able to tell him. And again, this is a man who created, you know, a father figure and a role model for me when I was young. And to be able to tell him what an impact he had on all of the people around him that he worked with, the other actors and the production people, it was a real privilege to share that with him.
That's amazing. Now, I know Leonard Nimoy, in one of this series episodes, he had a virus or something and then became like human, was crying, and then all of a sudden his fan mail increased like 10 times or something like that.
People
saw him as a human.
The Naked Tommy.
Yeah, of course that's in the book as well, because every episode has a chapter, and that's an episode called The Naked Time, as Vic just said, which was written by my friend John D.F. Black, who we just lost this last year. And he, the week after that aired, and that was the fourth episode they aired of the series. It was shot, it was maybe the sixth or seventh shot, but the others weren't ready to put on because special effects were delaying them. And the network was nervous about putting that on as the fourth episode, because in the story, everybody gets this virus, and it makes them become uninhibited. So Sulu is running around the Enterprise with the saber, because he always kind of thought of himself as a swashbuckler,
right,
and he's chasing crewmen, and people are just, you know, kind of, it's a part of their character, but they're not holding it in. And Spock gets affected by it. And he realizes he's been affected, but as a Vulcan, he doesn't want anybody to see him not be unemotional. And so he goes into the briefing room by himself, and he sits down in a chair, and he just starts sobbing. And Kirk comes in and finds him, and he just looks up at Kirk, and he says, "My mother, I was never able to tell her that I loved her," you know? And very strong, again, the material was just amazing.
Yeah.
And the very next week, thousands and thousands of letters were pouring in, that this character that NBC was so worried about, that America would not take to, people fell in love with this character. And then the memos, you see them in the book, start coming from NBC, and they start saying, "Hey, let's give Spock more stuff to do." he's getting more mail than the monkeys. Star Trek and Leonard Nimoy were getting more mail, more fan letters were coming in, boxes and boxes and bags, than even the monkeys were getting, which were on NBC at that time. So Star Trek was getting more mail than any other show on television.
Wow. Wow, isn't that amazing? I had no idea of that part of it. And as far as typecasting, you know, you think of Leonard Nimoy. He didn't do a lot after that. He did, you know, there were certain things he was in. Always great. Very fine actor. Kirk, Bill Shatner seemed to handle that well, going on to different things. But do you think a lot of people were...
Yeah.
typecasted and had nowhere to go after Star Trek?
Oh, they all told me that. Jimmy Doohan, Walter Koenig, who's a friend of mine as well, he just
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but can you tell the actor's name, but who they played in the...
Well, Jimmy Doohan was Scotty,
mm-hmm.
and Walter Koenig was Chekhov. And Walter just wrote the foreword for my new book coming out. Dorothy Fontana wrote the foreword for the last one. She'd been reading them all. Did you want to write the foreword? Sure. But Walter, you know, and so Jim Doohan and Walter Koenig especially, because both of them had done a lot of work on television before Star Trek, especially Jimmy Doohan, who was a little older and had been in more than 100 guest spots on different shows.
Wow.
And he was Canadian. But he was great with dialects. Mm-hmm. And so when Gene Roddenberry hired him for Star Trek, he said, "I want you to play the engineer. I'd like you to have an accent. What do you want to have?" And it was Jimmy Doohan who said, "I think, you know, he should be Scottish, because the Scots are always great with engines and machines and things and all that." Well, when Star Trek went off, he's suddenly not getting hired. You know, he'd be doing a dozen guest spots a year before Star Trek, and now suddenly he's doing one or two a year because... people would think, "Oh, we can't hire him. He's Scottish.
Unreal.
We don't need this character to have a Scottish accent." And so the same thing happened to Walter. He was really coming alive as an actor on television, doing a lot of guest stars, young, good-looking boy and everything. And then he gets on Star Trek, and they have him do the Russian.
The Russian
and
accent.
His parents were, his parents were Russian immigrants. So he was able to do that accent very well, because that's the way they sounded when he was growing up to him. And after Star Trek, it's like, well, we don't need a Russian, so we're not going to hire him. So that really hurt them in particular. Shatner, because he was so successful before Star Trek, had a series, had been a top TV guest star, he bounced right back.
Right.
Because they knew he could play anything.
Yeah.
Nimoy... was typecast as Spock, and he had done a lot of work for Star Trek before Star Trek II, and was a tremendous actor, but he wasn't getting offered the roles that he wanted. So he did 2 years on Mission Impossible so he could play a master of disguise and do dialects to try to show. Mm-hmm. And after that, he started doing more stage, and I mean Broadway, big stage, because he said, I just don't like the roles that are being offered to me. So he chose to do less television and film after Mission Impossible, and he kind of went to do the stage work where he could do Fiddler on the Roof and be singing and playing the lead and things of that nature, and Sherlock Holmes and stuff like that on Broadway. So that was an artistic choice of his.
Wow. I didn't realize he had a singing voice. That's amazing.
Oh, well, he did some records back in the 60s. Mr. Spock's Music from Outer Space.
Oh, my God.
Stuff like that.
About that, I remember Bell Shatner from Twilight Zone, several episodes he was in that, way back. Yeah.
And Bill Shatner was in a lot of movies, Judgment in Nuremberg, and he was one of the prosecutors in the movie. He had that series for The People. He was in the pilot for The Defenders, and they wanted him to play the son of E.J. Marshall, but he turned it down, so they hired Robert Reed. But Shatner was like the guy everybody was trying to get into a series.
I see.
And that's why he was one of the first ones that Roddenberry thought of. So it was Shatner, Jack Lord, and Robert Colfer, like the three go-to guys that everybody was trying to get for a series. And they even offered Captain Kirk to Jack Lord when Shatner wasn't available. And before they got Jeffrey Hunter, they went to Jack Lord and said, will you play this? Can you imagine?
That's something.
He wanted too much. He said he wanted a piece of the action. Shatner got 5% of the show. Jack Lord wanted something like 10 or 15%, so they turned him down. And then he was hired to do Hawaii Five-0, which turned out a pretty good show, and he owned a chunk of that.
Yeah. Amazing. You know, Martin, people sometimes make fun of Shatner, as they say, overacting. But, you know, back in that day, he was heralded as an incredible actor. I mean, he was a Shakespearean trained actor, and he was very, very, very highly respected as an actor. And I always find it funny when, you know, people nowadays want to, you know, take pot shots, but man, he was it was really something for them to get him for Star Trek, because he was highly respected for his abilities.
Okay. Right.
And
well, you see that in the books too. They were very excited when they got him, because they wanted him to begin with. And so when his show got canceled and they were able to bring him in, and he told Gene called him, he said, Shatner said, I love science fiction. You know, I've done a couple Twilight Zones, I've done Thriller, I've done all these things. I love science fiction. He came, saw the pilot, and he said, sign me up.
Wow.
I'm your captain.
Excellent.
And the memos in the book are just great, because like Bob Justman's going, we got Bill Shatner. now we're
awesome.
Going to go places.
Well, we are out of time. So I'd like for one at a time, we'll start with you, Mark. If you would just give out all your information so people can connect with, you know, to get to the book and all that.
You betcha. Well, my publisher is for these books is called Jacobs Frown Media Group, and they got their website, jacobsfrownmediagroup.com. But that's a hard thing to remember. So they also have a link to it, thesearethevoyagesbooks.com. And you can go there and you can read about the books. You can read excerpts from the books. You can hear excerpts from the audiobook, all that kind of stuff. Of course, the books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and so forth. But the nice thing about going to thesearethevoyagesbooks.com is if you get the book, it comes signed. You can even get it inscribed. I do them every day. They send me things and say, sign this book this way and the whole bit. And the audiobook is there. And it's also on a service called All Sound Inc., AWESOUND, Inc. You won't find the audiobook on Amazon. Actually, you will find a DVD set of the audiobook, but if you want it as a download to play in your mobile device as you're taking a drive across America and you need a 28-hour audiobook, you can download it to your mobile device from theseofthevoyagesbooks.com or allsoundinc.com.
All right. Well, I will have all these links in the show notes at podcastufo.com, also on YouTube. And we are just about out of time, so if you could quickly, Vic?
Yes. First of all, thank you so much for having us. As Mark said, the audiobook is available. Please check it out. You will love it. I want to give a shout out to Chelsea because not only is she amazing and wonderful, but she helped organize all of those actors and helped me figure out who spoke in what chapters. It was an enormous undertaking, and she's amazing. But you can check out StarTrekContinues.com, the website. All of our episodes are there, free to watch, all of it. Back behind-the-scenes videos, making-of videos, interviews, and all the episodes, all free. It's all for the love of Star Trek. I do a lot of event appearances around the country. If there are any Comic-Cons near you and you happen to see my name on the roster, come and say hello. NeutralZoneStudios.com is the website where you can find out information about touring our sets that we built.
Oh, yes.
And available.
I may check that out myself. Yeah.
Like us on Facebook, and we'll hope to see all of you at the studio.
Excellent. Thank you both so much. It's been a lot of fun for me. A really great way to wrap up the year. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Martin.
All right. Have a good night.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. All right, everyone. So that is it for the show. Thanks so much for listening. And we'll be back next week we have David O'Leary. He's the executive producer for Project Blue Book, as well as Sean Jablonski. They're both going to be on. And then Ted Rowe in the second hour. So we'll be back at the regular time on KGRA Radio, as well as YouTube, as usual. And I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. I want to give a special thanks to Michelle as well for helping out with our guest tonight. And again, very enjoyable. And we'll see you next week. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.